Hi, I'm Eric Kaplan, a TV writer in Hollywood with a PhD in philosophy.
And I'm Taylor Carman. I teach philosophy at Barnard College, Columbia University, and I lecture and write stuff about existentialism and phenomenology and truth, beauty, and the meaning of life.
And you're listening to Terrifying Questions and How Not to Be Terrified by Them. And what that is it's a philosophy podcast where we look at terrifying questions and we think about them and we try to find our way to a place where we and you can feel courageous.
Cool. So what is our terrifying question this week, Eric?
The terrifying question is, what if wisdom does not make us blessed? Which is an old-fashioned set of words, but what it sort of means is, what if understanding life and thinking deeply about us doesn't make us happy? What if it doesn't lead to the good life? And I find this a hard and terrifying question, and that's why we've invited a special guest, Professor Helen DeCruz. Professor DeCruz holds the Danforth Chair in the Humanities at St. Louis University. Before, she has had appointments as senior lecturer and associate professor at Oxford, Brooks University, was assistant professor at the VU Amsterdam, a postdoctoral fellow of the British Academy at Oxford University, was an FWO postdoctoral fellow at the University of Leuven, and was a Templeton residential fellow at Oxford University. She's currently working on a project on oneness, which is a grant funded by the Templeton Foundation via Hillsdale College. And also, you can see a fantastic book by her called Wonderstruck, How Awe and Wonder Shape the Way We Think, which will be out with Princeton University Press this winter. So we're really honored to have you on the podcast, and welcome.
Thank you for the invite. I look forward to talking to you about this.
So I don't know. I mean, you may be less given to bouts of terror than I am. But to me, I guess I'm worried that understanding life is not going to make me have a better life. And I can think of a couple of reasons why that might not be true. Like, it could be that what I learn when I understand life is going to be depressing or not helpful. And it could be that the whole procedure of trying to understand life is maybe dissociating me from my emotions and separating me from situations and people. So maybe it's a little bit of a like some kind of a spiritual Novocaine, this attempt to understand life. So those are my two worries, but I'm sure I have other worries. But what do you think about the basic issue before we get into like my personal problems with it? Does wisdom make us blessed?
Okay, so I'm just going to tell you how I got into this issue. So for the project on oneness that you mentioned, mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot of Spinoza. Mm-hmm. So I have successfully avoided reading any Spinoza. I was terrified of him, actually, to be honest, mm-hmm. because my undergraduate professor was going on about how super difficult it was. He leaned very heavily on the metaphysics of it. And I thought, I don't like metaphysics. I don't like metaphysics. and it was so metaphysics heavy, and it was extremely off-putting. So I thought, I'm not going to read this guy. But now with the project on oneness, I thought, well, the time has come. So I bought the complete works of Spinoza by Edwin Curly and started reading. And I still was very off-put by the ethics. So when I got to ethics, I first read some letters and different works by him. But then I sort of slowly, I don't know if you've had this feeling, you sort of get into it. You start thinking, yeah, this is really interesting. Like, this is such a great vision. Right. And by the end of it, I felt like I was a convert. Right. I was so enthusiastic. So
you have the zeal of the convert. That's
yes,
great.
Yes.
But before we dive into it, just can we get a two sentence for the folks at home? Who was Spinoza?
So Baruch Spinoza was a Dutch Jewish Portuguese philosopher who was born in Amsterdam. He was the son of a merchant. He was born somewhere in the 1630s. I should look that up. People thought he was so brilliant, so that he was certainly going to become a rabbi. Like, he was so full of discernment, and he understood Hebrew really well and the Torah and so on. But then they started to get worried about all his heterodox views. Mm. And then he got this very severe ban. So you have to think, like, the Netherlands, the Dutch Republic in the 17th century was like very cosmopolitan, very free people with all sorts of religious beliefs that were persecuted elsewhere, like Jews, they went there. So within his community, that Jewish community in Amsterdam, he got this very, very severe ban. Like, people couldn't come within 4 cubits of him. I don't know how big a cubit is. Like, maybe you guys know.
The king's arm.
Oh, yes. that you couldn't talk to him. So he was like severely banned. But actually, by all counts, he didn't mind. And then he moved to a different town called Voorburg. And then he corresponded a lot with like the luminaries of the time, like for example with Robert Boyle, you know, who is one of the founding fathers of chemistry, and with many other people as well. And so his ideas, particularly, so he had two books in particular. So he had the Political Theological Treatise, which basically says the Bible is a work of humans. And now this sort of sounds like, yeah, we say this, but at the time this was super radical.
Yeah.
And then you had the Ethics, which has like a vision. So it's a vision that God is the only substance. So we're all basically moods, as he would say it, moods of God. And actually understanding this and understanding how our emotions come about, etc., can lead you to a blessed life. So you can achieve blessedness, in his view, within your lifetime. You don't have to wait until some afterlife. You can achieve it within your lifetime. But anyway, all these works were so radical, like they were banned in the Dutch Republic, which was like super, you know, free thinking, right? Even so, like they were banned there. So he was a very radical thinker, and he still makes us think.
But you've been converted to Spinozism.
Oh, no, no, no. Well, I don't know. Like, it's almost like you can sort of really get into it and think, yeah, you know, if it's true, if we are all modes of God, right, it does seem plausible that, you know, if you accept his premises, so that ethics is written in this weird form, like it's like a mathematical proof. So you've got like all these axioms and definitions. If you accept all of that, then, you know, the conclusions follow as well that, you know, this is what you have to do to get a blessed life.
So have any of you, I mean, any of the three of us had an incident in the past week where we felt less than blessed?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So can you share it with us?
Can I just get clear about what blessedness is? Is it the same as happiness? Or what is blessedness?
Beatitudo. Or in Dutch, so there's also like, he has also some works that are in Dutch, although not probably originally written, Zaligheid. So actually, blessedness or beatitude is the best translation of this term in Latin or Dutch. And it means basically the state of a kind of what he calls mental acquiescence. So a sort of mental rest or repose where you like not sort of thinking about, I want this, I want that, I'm unhappy about this, oh, I feel worried about that, but where your mind is perfectly at ease.
Is it like the ancient Stoic ataraxia or apatheia?
It's similar to that. And it's definitely like there's definitely influence of Stoic thought there. So, yeah, but you also have it in Christian tradition. And he was aware of that as well.
Yeah.
So you have this idea of like in Aquinas, this idea where you have the beatific vision. You see God and that's all you do until eternity. So you stand on a crystal ball looking at God forever. But that's not Spinoza's vision. That's Aquinas's vision. But it's OK, because there's nothing more you want. Like, if you can see God, what more would you want?
But it's probably not like a contemporary view that a lot of people have nowadays, where happiness is like pleasure and sitting by the pool and having a lot of money and being successful and stuff like that. It's some other kind of state of well-being.
That's right. That's right.
But not the satisfaction of a lot of appetites, I guess. Huh?
That's right. Because Spinoza basically says, if you chase your appetites, you're never going to be happy.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And this is such a deep insight. You have it in Buddhism as well. The problem is that if you start chasing your passions and you say, oh yeah, I want a yacht, I want a super yacht, I want parties. You know, there's always more things that you want.
It never stops.
It never stops. And like, think about like people like Elon Musk. Like, you would think with that amount of wealth, if satisfying your desires make you happy, he would have to be the happiest man on earth. But he doesn't seem
like he is.
It doesn't seem like he's so petty. He
seems miserable. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to trade places with him.
Yeah.
So that's when I'm thinking, like, maybe it's not so difficult to become, well, blessed, rather than like happiness. Like, I don't know, like, take this notion of blessedness. Maybe it's within our grasp, or maybe not.
Yeah, interesting.
So I want to get the picture first. So the idea is, the best thing to be is this state of sort of equanimity, where I don't care if my desires are satisfied.
Yes.
And I can achieve that by understanding Spinoza's philosophy. Is that's the two-part program?
That's the two-part program. So the idea is like, so the ethics, this is my third time trying to read it. And one reason that it took me three times is that I found it extremely off-putting, because it's written in this sort of really, like, with proposition one, here is a proposition, here is the proof for the proposition, QED, and here are some corollaries and scholia, etc. Like, I find it off-putting. But actually, you know, the general consensus is that he worked on this most of his active research life, that he didn't choose this on a whim, that he really took the form as a kind of therapy. So the form is therapeutic in itself. It's deliberately not passionate writing. So this is another thing. 17th century people started realizing how the passions, how our emotions at the time called passions, really could lead us astray. Like if you think about, for example, Shakespeare plays are all about people who have misperceptions, right? Like Romeo and Juliet, they commit double suicide because their passions lead them in the wrong direction. And Othello, you know, he thinks that his wife is cheating on him and that's why he does what he does. So there was a big awareness of like, you know, you have to like convince people, and rhetoric was very important in music and painting. But the ethics is deliberately written in this very cool style, in this passionate style, because it has to calm you. You have to read it contemplatively and you have to become calm as a result. So it's almost like reading it is a spiritual exercise.
Mm-hmm. So what I propose, maybe a way to organize our conversation, would be to first talk about how would this understanding of being all part of God, or maybe he has a more precise way of saying that, but for the same being, we're all part of God, and that will make us not care about satisfying our desires. I want to talk about that, but then I'd also like to talk about, is this state of not caring if your desires are satisfied, is it worth aspiring to? But I'd like to, if that's okay, I'd like to talk about the first one first. So what's an example from any of our lives where we felt bad because of our passions? I mean, it doesn't need to be super disclosing, but like in the last week, did anybody have an experience where you felt bad because of your passions?
Definitely. I've been fighting with the Institutional Review Board at SLU, and it's just awful. I'm just going to go on record with them. Like they're the most baroque Byzantine organization that I've had to deal with getting institutional review approval.
What does institutional review approval mean?
Oh yeah, if you work with human participants, then you need to like make sure that you're not doing like creepy experiments on people. And so a board of people will review whether you are in fact being ethical in your work with participants.
Okay, so let's say you wake up, and I don't know if you drink coffee, but you have a cup of coffee, and you open up your email and there's a letter from an idiotic bureaucrat saying something idiotic and stupid.
Yeah.
And you don't need to mention their name. It might not be politically good for you, but you receive a letter from an idiotic bureaucrat and you're like, I'm really mad.
I'm so angry.
What an idiot.
Yeah.
And it ruins your morning.
Exactly.
And Spinoza would say what? That the bureaucrat is part of God and you're part of God?
Problem solved.
Like what does Spinoza say you're supposed to do?
Problem solved. Right. So basically, you have to recognize that your passions are. So on the one hand, he says, you are a mode of God, you're a human being. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that human beings do is self-preservation. So you tend towards self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why you have these passions. So they have this function of, you know, avoiding things that could get you killed or sick.
Mm-hmm.
Going towards things that are good for you. And that's all fine, right? You can do that, right? And
oh, you can do that.
Yeah,
he doesn't
you
think
can,
I should just stand there and let the tiger gobble me up.
No. And in fact, okay. Suicide, he says, like, you know, you'd be going against, you know, your human nature if you committed suicide. It's not that he condemns
you. So how come I can punch the tiger in the face, but you can't metaphorically punch the bureaucrat in the face? What's the difference?
So the problem is these passions, they give rise to all sorts of things that he thinks are bad, such as ambition and chasing prestige, for example, or resentment and jealousy. So he has this rather funny passage where he talks about that you're jealous because there is this woman and you know she's with somebody else, and then you get extra upset because you are thinking about how her parts are mixed with his or something to that effect, and you get
I hate that. Yeah,
that is very upsetting.
Oh, I've been there. Yeah, that is upsetting to think
about.
Yeah,
but
that.
The problem is there's nothing you can do, right? There's nothing, you cannot make this stop, right? Unless you're a horrible person who,
well, okay, I mean, I don't know, you could write a really persuasive letter to her about why she should mix her parts with yours rather than his. I mean, there's stuff you can do.
Yeah.
Well, in the moment, there's nothing you can do. I mean, raging about it while you are incapable of doing anything about it is...
Well, I'm trying to understand the view. Is it just like, if you can't win, don't fight? Or is it like, don't fight at all?
Well, if the fighting arises, here's where, you know, I'm not a Spinoza scholar. If the fighting arises from your self-preservation, then yes. But, you know, the self-preservation is quite minimalistic, mm-hmm. right? It's not like stand your ground laws or something like that here, right? It's really like literally, mm-hmm. right? You want to survive. You want to survive and keep yourself alive. But beyond that, there are things that you start to chase that are just empty. For example, he gives the example of prestige. So prestige is bad in his view mm-hmm. because it is an empty good. It's an empty good because the only reason we value it is that other people value it. So that's the only thing that gives it value.
Uh-huh.
Moreover, in the end, you chase it more for the sake of winning and crushing your enemy than for the sake of actually being happy of getting the position that gives you prestige. So you're chasing this empty good.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically making it difficult to live with other people, because that's the other thing that I find interesting in his philosophy, is that he does think it's important for people to live together in a society, and that that makes possible things like art and science, which he mentions, you know, you can't do this on your own. You need a community of people.
Right.
And actually, he thinks we wouldn't need government if people were perfectly rational. Because if we were perfectly rational, we would be pursuing all these things that bring us good things, you know, like art and science, and we would be happily living together. But the problem is that our passions lead us astray.
Mm-hmm.
They lead us to do things suboptimally. You know, they could be useful, but they very often are not in guiding us to do the things that are ultimately to our benefit.
Let's take a short break and come right back and pick up on this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back with Helen de Cruz talking about Spinoza and equanimity and how to achieve blessedness.
By the way, feel free at any point, you can speak in propria persona. Like, you can say what you think. We don't all have to be trying to do Spinoza exegesis.
Yeah.
So do you think it's true? Do you think that passions, like if you could press a button and have no more passions, would you?
Oh, no, I don't think so. So I do think that, you know, I try to use my passions in a productive way. It sounds horribly instrumentalizing, but I do try to like attenuate when I feel angry, like with the IRB. I'm thinking, look, I'm not going to write my response to them because I'm going to be so mad and then it's not going to be productive. So I'm just going to calm myself down and do it after the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and we all have management techniques like that, but I do think that, you know, our emotions are just part overall of our good life. So, yeah, I don't know if I agree.
So this is not a view of eliminating emotions. This is more just taking emotions and giving them a second look before you punch someone in the face or...
That's right,
you know,
yeah. I think you have to be...
Decide to leave your family for a movie star or something yeah. like that.
I think you have to be super thoughtful about your emotions. Like, there's now a lot of work about anger, whether anger can ever be good, can ever be rational. So you have this recent book by Maisha Sherry, where she says, yes, it can be useful, you know, in the fight against racism. If people like Owen Flanagan, who say, no, anger is never good. Anger always leads us astray. So I think in a sense that our emotions, and I'll say more about that in my book on wonder, I think actually that we do use our emotions in ways that help us. Like, I think that our emotions have a part in human life and that they should be cultivated in ways that help us to get around better. You know, it's difficult to be a human.
I wonder, in the case of anger, and I'm actually somebody, because of my own childhood, that I kind of repress my anger. I'm scared of my anger. But I feel like if I was the kind of person who, like, if you tried anything with me, I would blow up. Now, maybe in the individual case, I might lose something, but maybe in the course of my life, I might gain something because people would be less inclined to try something with me, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So like, if they're like, Professor de Cruz is very nice and we can just string her along and send her a bunch of nonsense because she's so nice. In fact, she studies Spinoza. She's probably not going to cause a problem, but if they were terrified of you, and they're like, watch out for her. She's going to bite your head off. Maybe ultimately in the course of your career, and I'm not saying this is true, I'm just sort of being a devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the course of your career, you'd get more done because you'd build the reputation as someone not to be messed with. Like, what do you think about that? And what does Spinoza think about that?
I feel like with that, so I'll just talk from my own point of view here. I mm-hmm. feel like, so there is an interesting game theoretical dynamic to this, right? The dynamic you describe is the dynamic of the bully.
Mm-hmm.
So the bully has a big advantage that people will back off, you know, or people will even internalize the bully and think, oh no, mm-hmm. Eric is going to freak out when I say this. So I'm not even going to propose it because Eric is going to shoot it down. And then, you know, like that sort of thing. But on the other hand, there are lots of things, opportunities that you forgo if you were a bully.
Oh, like what?
Of collaboration with me, because I'd say like, you know, what if he blows up?
I see.
Like, I can't risk it. I'm just not going to approach him. I'll approach Taylor instead.
There you go.
He's much nicer. Uh-huh. Like, you know, so right. So there are, I think that with that sort of strategy, like I feel you shouldn't be like sort of cold and calculating, but maybe just a little bit and think, what sort of life do I want? I wouldn't be able to live the life of a bully because people wouldn't trust me.
It does seem that in some social circumstances, other people being a bully makes it harder for you not to be because you have to keep up. Maybe this is a game theoretic part of it, which is what advantages you get from blessedness or equanimity may be curtailed by the fact that you're in a highly competitive environment, in which case you're going to lose out a lot more. Whereas if everybody mm-hmm. attained this kind of equanimity or blessedness or cooperation, then it would be easier for us all to rise to the level of this virtue.
I have a cynical response to that, and I find this actually terrifying.
Uh-huh.
In those societies where everybody is nice,
yeah.
the one person who chooses to be a bully
yeah.
gets a windfall.
Well, that's right. Well, that's true. I mean, yeah, there's a kind of a paradox about it, right? Exactly. That the bully maybe is happy
yeah.
if he gets to hang around with a bunch of weaklings. So I wonder if Spinoza says anything about this. Is he sensitive to the fact that some environments are going to be more conducive to the kind of virtues, maybe the Stoic virtues, than others?
So definitely. In the political theological treatise, he talks a lot about that. So he has lots of stuff on like social contract theory that you also have in people like Hobbes and Locke. But his view is very interesting. So he does agree with you that, yes, it would be great if everybody had this equanimity, if everybody, you know, was rationally pursuing things that would benefit everybody. But the problem is indeed, like, you just have one or two bullies and it's screwed up, it's bad. So he says, what is the purpose of government? The purpose of government is really freedom. So how does it give us freedom? Government is not supposed to turn us into automata. So he says, not supposed to turn you into slaves or to turn you into machines. What it does is it actually enables you to be more rational. So it puts constraints. It basically subdues, you know, a few people who would otherwise like, you know, mm-hmm. just go for their own gain, or lots of people who like have a crazy idea. So this is the thing, like what government does is it reins those in. It reins in the passions, and it allows people, he says, to be equal, like you would be in the state of nature, but then without all the irrationality. So that's his idea. You'd be more equal. That's also why he thinks that government should be the democracy and not like, for example, Hobbes thought that a sole monarch would be the best person. Like you give all your ability to do all sorts of things to this one monarch. But Spinoza thinks that a democratic government is better because he thinks, and it's interesting to think about this in the American political context, that many different voices would cancel out any sort of irrationality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's right. Because of the game theoretical dynamics, we do need some sort of social contract so that we are not in the thralls of just a few people who just have crazy ideas, and then we're all being pulled around by them.
So the blessedness, I just want to make a good case for it, because it does seem attractive. Like when something bad happens, like you've got a great idea for a project, and then some foolish bureaucrat says no, what are you supposed to do in order to be a happy camper, be a blessed soul?
I think that in general, you just try to do the best you can under the circumstances. Like it's difficult to have like a utopian politics, because politics seems to me more like the idea of what is possible and what you can do realistically. But on the other hand, so this is like my reading of it, the ethics is what people call a perfectionist ethics,
mm-hmm.
in that there is this sort of perfect state, and it's this perfectly wise, rational man, or person, as you would now say, gender inclusively. And this person is like this exemplar that you can strive towards.
And what's it like? Like, does this person have children?
Oh, yeah, yeah, they could. He says, yeah, you know, it could be part of your rational project, you know, to be married if that's your thing, right? It's not his thing. Like, he never was married. He never had any children. But yeah, you could. If you wanted to have children,
that's okay.
Rationally raise them. Yeah, that's all good.
So let's go through the life. Like, you wake up, you're a rational person, and I guess you learn things, right? And then you're like, I would like to get married. And how do you decide who to ask?
So he has a little piece on marriage. I think it's in book 4, but I'm not entirely sure. Where, you know, you just find somebody with whom you can pursue this rational project of having children, of building a life together. You know, you have to be compatible and so on.
Let's say I ask the first person,
yeah,
and she says no. Do I feel bad?
Well, I mean, inevitably, you'll feel a bit sad. So he does talk about like all those emotions.
I do feel sad. So that's okay.
That's okay. So he basically, his psychology. So here's the idea that basically there's only 3 kinds of emotions, but they mix together to make like a very wide palette of emotions. So you have basically joy, mm-hmm, like when something good happens, like she says yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have sadness, where she says no.
Right.
And then you have desire. And desire is that sort of drive, the drive for you to preserve yourself, basically. And so it's a very fundamental drive. It's not like Buddhist philosophy, where this is the thing to get rid of or something like that. You'll have that. But what you have to avoid is, for example, in this case, and I'd have to double check because he has this very, very elaborate taxonomy. You have this desire, but then she says no. So you feel sad. So you feel like jilted, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, like there's no productive role anymore for this emotion. It doesn't help. So you have to try to rid yourself of it.
So blessedness, I just want to make this clear. A blessed life will include episodes of sadness. Is that right?
So practically speaking, yes. But this sort of hypothetical exemplar in my reading of it, I also have to say, like Alex Douglas is writing a book about this. The book's coming out. It's about Spinoza's blessedness. I'm about halfway in the book.
Well, how about just for you? Is a blessed life achievable that will include no episodes of sadness or frustration?
Personally, I don't think it's realistic. Mm. And I think in Spinoza's view, it's like this sort of goal. And so imagine this, like, so you have this like perfect man, and he thinks that, you know, you can do things that move you closer to this ideal, and then you can do things that move you further away. For example, chasing ambitions, prestige, mm-hmm, people who don't want you, that's moving you further away from the exemplar. Whereas doing things, you know, like rationally pursuing joint projects, that moves you like closer.
Mm-hmm.
But he does hold out the hope that it is achievable, but it's very difficult. Like at the end of the Ethics, he says, I realize this is difficult, and I would have to go to the exact quote if you like, because it's beautiful to read it out to you. So just if you let me.
Yeah, please.
Where he says, yes, I realize this is difficult, but you know, that's just how it is. With this, I have finished all the things I wish to show concerning the mind's power over the emotions and its freedom. From what has been shown, it is clear how much the wise man is capable of and how much more powerful he is than one who is ignorant and driven only by lust. For not only is the ignorant man troubled in many ways and unable to ever possess true peace of mind, but he also lives as if he neither knew himself nor God nor all the things. And as soon as he ceases to be acted upon, he ceases to be. So on the other hand, the wise man is hardly troubled in spirit. So you see hardly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being by a certain eternal necessity, conscious of himself and of God and of things, he never ceases to be, but always possesses true peace of mind. And here comes the crucial bit. If the way I have shown to lead to these things now seems very hard, still it can be found. And of course, what is found so rarely must be hard. For if salvation were at hand and could be found without great effort, how could nearly everyone neglect it? But all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. So it's tough, but that's how it is.
I wanted to ask about the difficulty, whether we can just choose to be wise and therefore blessed, or what kind of effort it might take. It's like Plato thinks you've got these non-rational parts of your soul, and you kind of have to fight them. It's unclear what the fight consists in exactly, but there is a tug-of-war, push-and-pull kind of struggle.
Yeah.
And Hume thinks you're just the slave of your passions, and you cannot voluntarily just decide to have reason prevail over the passions. There's no way that can happen.
Right. But on the other hand, so Descartes says, and Spinoza was definitely influenced, that there is no soul so weak, says Descartes, in the passions of the soul, they would not have absolute control over their passions, right? That's a strong statement.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a little bit more like the Stoics, which is that you can, in principle, just decide to control your passions or your emotions. But that seems a little in tension with what you were just reading. I mean, when he says, if it were easy, everybody would do it and it would be no problem and there wouldn't be much value in it. So it's always very difficult to see what the difficulty, unless the difficulty just is a purely intellectual difficulty of just seeing clearly what you ought to do and deciding to do it. Is that the idea?
For Spinoza, yes. Because for Spinoza, there is a unity between doing and knowing. So the knowing God, actually, what is blessedness? So I didn't quite say that yet. What blessedness is loving and knowing God. And since we are just all modes of God, it's basically a kind of, and this is just my gloss on it, right? Everybody has a different idea about what he means. Being at peace with the universe, being at peace with your place in it and loving it as it is. And, you know, one of the really hard things he says, like, so you have the problem of evil, right? So how does he deal with that? Well, he says it doesn't exist. That's just our position, our particular position. We might say, oh, it would have been great if this one woman had said yes, but in the bigger scheme of things, it could not have gone otherwise. So he thinks we have no free will, that even God doesn't have free will, that God creates of necessity. It had to happen. So you have to feel at peace with that. Like everything that happens had to happen. And blessedness is realizing that. So that's the hard message. I mean, I don't know if I'm a determinist in that sort of strong sense as Spinoza is, but that's like...
So it does seem like there's a connection where you would say, this bureaucrat has denied my project, but I shouldn't be mad.
No, not denied. He just asks for all sorts of things to change it, the project, so that
worse.
Eventually...
It's worse than just denying it.
Well, I'm coming up with a counterexample, like a philosophical example of a bureaucrat who's worse than the real bureaucrat that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a bureaucrat, and the bureaucrat is making you jump through a lot of hoops. But is Spinoza saying, but that's the nature of a bureaucrat? So how can you be angry at a bureaucrat for behaving like a bureaucrat, and you're part of a bureaucratic civilization which has all sorts of checks and balances, and so therefore to rage against a bureaucrat for being a bureaucrat is like raging against the winter snow for being cold. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Is that the message?
I think it is what it is. It sounds a bit facile, but there is definitely a part to that you have to realize. And obviously, you know, practically speaking, like if you look at Spinoza's life, so Stephen Nadler, Spinoza expert, he says that he achieved pretty much the thing that he said to do, right? He was somebody who didn't care about wealth. In fact, he had this rich friend who wanted to make him his heir, but he said, no, I don't want this money. He refused a professor position. He refused an annuity. So he lived as a boarder in rented rooms, like, you know, but nonetheless, he would do things to, you know, further his goals. Like, for example, there were people translating a book of his and he was very worried that it would, like, you know, people would get really mad. So he stopped the translation in Dutch of that book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that he was saying, oh, I'm just going to let things flow, whatever, you know, I mean, you're just still doing things in the world, right?
So he chose his battles.
He picked his battles, I think, carefully. And I think he was very wise as about, you know, how money can corrupt, for example, or how positions can corrupt. So he thought that he had more freedom grinding lenses. So that was his day job than being a professor. And maybe there's something to that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take another quick break and we will be right back. I'm going to go back to Eric's worry about, there's two things now that I'm thinking about. One is this preponderance of the role of reason, because I think when I think about taking a purely intellectual attitude to thinking about my life and how to live it and so on, I may wind up with a very impoverished idea about the possibilities that lie in front of me, and a purely rational approach to my life might lead to some kinds of austerity, like I will avoid conflict. Choosing my battles carefully sounds like a good thing, but on the other hand, it also might mean avoiding risks and not exercising my passions in a way that would risk further unhappiness, which means I might just rent a room instead of buying a house or stay single instead of having a family because it's safer. So there's one thing about, is theoretical reason going to give us a practical wisdom?
Right.
And I think a more Aristotelian view might be that your practical wisdom is going to allow you to acquire skills and know how to navigate the world and deal with it in a realistic way. Maybe a purely theoretical application of reason is going to impoverish your life. And then the other thought that I had is that maybe there's just something idiosyncratic about this ethic, and it suits people like Spinoza, but it doesn't suit everybody. So maybe it's not generalizable. Maybe it's a kind of autobiographical confession about the kind of life that's appealing to him because of a quirk of his character. What do you think about either of those? They're sort of connected, but they're two different points.
Yeah, they're two different points. So I think, yeah, I think we can...
What are the 2 points? I got lost. Let's just pick the say the 2 points and then decide. Point one.
Right. The first point is the worry that just trying to apply a kind of theoretical rationality to these problems, like Spinoza was trying to do in thinking not just rationally, but geometrically in terms of axioms and theorems about what wisdom and blessedness might look like, is going to lead to an impoverished idea about your real possibilities and the real prospects of happiness and unhappiness in life.
Yeah, is his caution selling us short? Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other worry is that maybe his particular kind of rationalistic caution is an idiosyncrasy of his, and we shouldn't think it's generalizable.
And is it just for him? Well, let's talk about the first one.
Yeah.
What are we missing? Are we missing anything worthwhile? Like, one of the things I was thinking was, like, if I'm in a society where 100 people passionately try to, I don't know, create a beautiful song, and they passionately try and do it, and they wipe themselves out. Now, 99 of them may be miserable because they fail, but one of them might succeed, and then I'll be happy, and we'll all be happy. So if we live in a society where people are passionately killing themselves and miserable in the achievement of goals, maybe more goal achieving will happen, even though there'll be some sacrifice.
Yeah, I feel like this sort of goes back to Nussbaum's idea. I was thinking, Taylor, when you were talking about this, Nussbaum in The Fragility of Good, she juxtaposes sort of a Platonic idea versus an Aristotelian idea in ancient philosophy, but I think it generalizes. So on the one hand, Aristotelian ideas like luck really does play a role in human lives. You can be unlucky and then you can become miserable through no fault of your own. But that makes the good precious. The good is like this precious flower that is all the more beautiful for, you know, its fragility. On the other hand, so that's Aristotelian thought, or that's the way that Nussbaum reads it. On the other hand, you have the Platonic idea about I can insulate myself from all the slings and arrows of life. You see it also in the Stoics. Like with the Stoics, you could be like super miserable. Like for Aristotle, and this is very ableist, you couldn't be disabled and happy, like, or it'd be very hard. But for the Stoics, you could be disabled and happy because the only thing that matters to them is virtue. Right. And virtue is under your control. And actually, I think...
Could you be mentally disabled and happy? No, right?
I think for the Stoics, probably not, right? Because you do need to pursue the virtues.
Okay, that's good.
And of course, it's possible to be mentally disabled and pursue the virtues. It really depends, I think, on the specifics of the mental disability.
Sure, sure, sure.
So I think I read Spinoza more in terms of like the Platonic strand.
Yeah.
That no matter how your life goes, you know, the blessedness, the loving God, and realizing your place in the economy of nature does not depend on your specific circumstances. Any rational agent can do it. So you sort of insulate yourself from unhappiness. You insulate yourself from luck. And I don't know. I've been going back and forth about this. Like, honestly, if you'd asked me in 2019, I'd say, oh, yes, I'm an Aristotelian at heart. And, you know, I think that there is such a thing as luck. But then the pandemic struck and it honestly made me so miserable. Like, it was a really, really tough period of my life. Like, we now all sort of like want to go happily on. But honestly, I was so miserable. And then I thought there is something to this other strand, this perfectionist strand, where it's not really your specific idiosyncratic life circumstance. It's achievable. It's actually sort of a democratic ideal almost, right? Like you don't have to be like a wealthy, freeborn, etc. You can be anybody and achieve some form of blessedness, happiness, whatever you might call it.
And it might not actually necessarily entail cautiousness, because what you could say on that view is just that the bar is a lot higher, because you can take a lot of risks. You just have to be ready to withstand losses with equanimity.
That's right. Yeah.
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 Yeah, I couldn't help wondering, we're all a mode of God. We're all part of God. So that means, well, it sort of raises the question, why is everybody so miserable? What's the role of the fall? What plays the conceptual role of the fall in Spinoza's system? Because if we're all determined and we're all part of God, then it seems like there wouldn't be any problems. There wouldn't be anybody who is a raging, miserable egomaniac driven by status and lust, or that raging, miserable egomaniac driven by status and lust is also a mode of God. So that's fine. Like, I'm not quite sure what my problem is, but I'm wondering, like, how you have both. We're all part of God, but there's a problem and there's work to do in order to become blessed. How do those work together?
It's super interesting to see Spinoza's views on the fall. And here I'm following Douglas, who I think has a good idea about this. So basically, he says that Spinoza's idea of the fall is very much influenced by Maimonides, who has a Jewish conception, because after all, Spinoza was born Jewish. He was excommunicated from the Jewish community, but he does have that heritage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a difference in that, you know, for Christianity, the fall basically damaged us forever. And, you know, you have to like get grace, etc., etc. For Judaism, there is also the fall, but it's sort of cashed out differently. And one of the things that Maimonides was wondering at, like, people ate from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So how is this not like a gain? How is this a loss, right? Because we lost something, like, why didn't we gain something? And the idea, the Spinozistic account, is that we actually are in this sort of fall, but he does call it a story, right? So because he thinks that these are stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not like...
That's okay.
Yeah, so he has this idea of the Bible as something that is written by humans. But in the story, you can see how humans, you know, they get gripped by these passions. So they do lose something. And that's why they feel things as good and evil. Like, they aren't truly good and evil, but they perceive them that way because they are in the thralls of their passions, right? That is the problem.
Well, like, where does error come from? How could there even be an error in Spinoza's view?
Yeah. So you, for example, you don't know what's all going on in your body. So you don't have like mind-body dualism like he has with, like you have with Descartes, but you don't have an adequate knowledge of what's all going on in your body. You do like have proprioception and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, imagine you now had cancer, you don't, right? But imagine if you did and you didn't know about it, well, like, you know, so there's a certain opacity. And similarly, you can also be mistaken in other ways. Like, you think, I really want this. This is really going to make me happy. You could be mistaken about that. So you're just a limited, so you are mood, you're a certain presentation of God. You are not like literally all of God, because God, of course, has adequate ideas. God has ideas, you know, as they are, but as just one mood of God, you don't have those.
So there are parts of God that don't know what's going on, basically. Is that the idea? That God is sort of...
Yeah.
God is sort of has some lack of integration, like he doesn't quite know what's going on in himself?
Yeah, so God is one substance, but to my best understanding, and this is honestly the part of the ethics I struggled most with, is part 2 and 3, you do not thereby have adequate ideas. That's how you come into error.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, or not always. Like, and blessedness is in fact acquiring ideas that are adequate ideas about God's nature, about, you know.
So maybe it's something like God coming back into his own, like God losing himself and coming back to himself?
Maybe. I don't know. That's possible.
That sounds like Hegel's version of Spinoza.
Yeah.
Something more like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
But the problem here sounds like an intellectual problem.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no free will, it can't just be like Descartes, like Plato. I think both of them think there's a way in which the intellect is, as such, infallible. And for Descartes, mistake comes in through the exercise of our will, like we overreach our ideas and so on.
Yeah, but with Spinoza, you don't have that, you don't have the distinction between intellect and will, because is actually no such thing. Like, so you do have this drive, this desire, and that's something that can lead you, even though it's good, it helps you preserve yourself, it could lead you astray.
Yeah, interesting.
So where do we land on this? Do we think... Like, just as people or thinkers, not Spinoza scholars, do we think that wisdom leads to blessedness?
So I'm going to go and say that I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly do. I've had lots of periods in my life that were joyful, and then I've had lots of periods in my life that were dreadful. And I kind of feel like having this more sort of like platonic, spinozistic, you know, this sort of idea of at least trying to see myself as part of nature, right? As part of the world, you know, and in the grand scheme of things, and I don't mean that in a bad way, you know, I'm going to die not too long from now, you know, the world's going to roll on. It does give you a sense of perspective and a sense of peace. So I'm going to say that I hope, like, it's never going to be perfect. Like, I'm still going to get upset. But I do think, like, I actually hope as philosophers, and this goes back to, you know, one thing that Kant says in the Critique of Pure Reason. So Kant said that there are three big questions for philosophy, namely, what can we know? What should I do? What may I hope? And I think for all of those, actually, it really is incumbent upon us as philosophers to try to find, you know, some little piece of the puzzle of each of these three things. And actually, that it is good for us to, at the very least, try to incorporate some of this in our lives. Like, I often hear philosophers extremely deprecating about philosophers, like, oh, come on, like, why would you want to marry a philosopher? I married a philosopher, by the way, but why would you want to, like, we are such awful people the whole time. And I'm thinking, like, why would you think that, right? I mean, I genuinely think philosophy is great and it can lead us. I hope at least it does. It can give us some insight and wisdom that we otherwise wouldn't have.
For my part, I certainly hope, and I think I believe that wisdom leads to blessedness. But I think I must have a very different idea of wisdom from Spinoza's, because I think that a lot of the wisdom that is more likely to lead to blessedness is going to look less like geometry than like a long accumulation of accidental, difficult sorts of bits of wisdom you pick up only through painful experience and common sense and aging and perspective. Mm-hmm. It's going to involve intuitive and affective things that you can only get by tumbling through life and groping around and finding your way, and something much more accidental and ununified than anything like a rational system like Spinoza's. But that's just my gut feeling.
Could I just add something very briefly to that? So one thing I've been thinking lately is that, so I grew up a working class, very blue collar family. Like, my father was a bricklayer, and the person who lived across from us was a very wise farmer. So she was a single woman, and she had like cows and sheep. And you're wondering, where am I going with this? But there's a point. But like, she was super uneducated. Like, she had difficulty. She could read and write, but like with great difficulty. She was super uneducated. She was very religious, but she still seemed very wise to me. So I'd often go across the road, you know, to have a look at the lambs and stuff like that. And, you know, over the years, I've been thinking, and also I've seen like so many colleagues of my father, like, again, they only went to school until middle school and that sort of thing. Like, they, you know, knew how to make build bricks. And so I've often thought, like, now I'm always surrounded by academics, but I think that there genuinely is a kind of wisdom that you can acquire. And it is philosophical in nature, I think, but you don't necessarily have to have the discipline of philosophy, right? So it is what you say, like the accumulation of things. I still think that it's valuable to do philosophy, but it's like, I'm a pluralist about these things, right? So I think there's many ways to blessedness. And I think actually that neighbor, that farmer, she was pretty close.
Wow.
Do you have any final things? I'm curious, like, let's say a person, either a young person who's feeling miserable or a person experiencing a midlife crisis is feeling miserable and is listening to this podcast. Can you offer some hopeful words about blessedness and why it's possible and what's so great about it?
Okay, so I'm thinking, like, read The Ethics. Like, honestly, it's such a great read. Like, you could disagree, and you can find online versions of The Ethics that are free. And you could just see, like, is this something for me? I think that, in fact, so there are so many different philosophies that promise us some form of equanimity. And there's always themes that recur, like, don't chase material things and don't get too gripped by your desire. And in fact, Pierre Hadot said that this is one of the main things philosophy does, is help us to get out of the grip of our passions. And it's definitely a theme that recurs, find some sort of peace with us being in the world. I'm also a pluralist in that I think there's many, many different ways to get there. And I actually encourage people to experiment. Like, you can do it yourself. It's never been easier, right? With podcasts and so on. Like, you have to find your way around, and it's worthwhile. I think it's worthwhile to be cognizant about your life and about finding happiness and stuff like that. I think it's a worthwhile enterprise. It's worth devoting some time to it. Like, I mean, we devote time to so many things, right? We work out, as Avicenna said, you know, you work out, you try to preserve your body. So why shouldn't you do the same amount of effort to preserve your soul? I know that sounds dualistic, right? But I just mean to say that I do think that being thoughtful about, you know, your values and about your place in the world is really part of the good life.
Mm, good.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it seems like I certainly feel like I live, I'm a Hollywood writer, and I live in a sort of a subculture that's sort of poisoned by status seeking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worthwhile to sometimes be like, well, is that making me happy? Mm-hmm. And if it's not, do something different. You know, that our emotions are not just visited upon us by our unconscious, but they're also something that we can take control of and master and at least have a respectful dialogue with.
Hmm. Yeah.
Good. Well, with that, shall we wrap up? And thank you so much, Helen, for appearing on our podcast. It was a terrific discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was a great discussion. I hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Be well and okay. Be blessed and be wise.
Yeah, yeah. Bless you. Bless you. I like that. Baruch. Baruch means blessing. So have a blessed evening.
Gesundheit.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast is created by Eric Kaplan and Taylor Carman, produced by Amanda Eberhardt, and edited by me, Taylor Carman. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as Terrifying Questions.